I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Series 3, Episode 2 of Old Brother, a podcast about Salford / Manchester's legendary musical institution, The Fall. Each week we invite on a guest to chat about their experiences and memories of the group. You can find us at Spotify, Apple and all usual suspects, but we're hosted at play.acast.com/s/Old Brother. All episodes are also available on YouTube. Search for Old Brother Podcast and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. This week we're joined by the marvellous David Nolan, who discusses his career as producer at Granada, his writing and documentary making, and of course his fascinating interactions with The Fall. Hope you enjoy it. Hello, yeah. Welcome to the latest edition of Old Brother. I nearly forgot the name of the programme, and that's good, isn't it? The latest edition of Top of the Pops, with me, Paul Hanley, and my brother Steve. And
hello.
Delighted. Hello, Steve. You well?
Yeah, I'm okay, yeah.
Good. Right, so this week we're delighted to welcome... Now, we'll have to find out what his preferred job title is. It says... we've got on Wikipedia, it's television producer and author. I suspect he's more the latter than the former now, but we can say that. That's Mr. David Nolan, author of I Wish I Was There. I Wish I Was There. See, I'm doing very well here.
No.
I wish I was there.
If you can't even get the name of the book, it's Fred Carno, this
I
is.
I swear I was there. That's
it's
the one,
Fred Carno, this.
It's you. It's you wishing you were there.
This is slick. I wish I was there. I know. I swear I was there. Anyway. So, good morning, David. How are you? You well?
Not so bad, yeah, not so bad.
Busy?
I try not to be too busy because that's a mugs game, isn't it? But, I'm just cracking on and I'm doing, got a new novel out, so I've been out and about kind of flogging that in my endless library tour. I'm the Bob Dylan of libraries. I just endlessly go and do talks at libraries and...
It's a wonder you can find enough these days.
Well, do you know, that's a weird thing. We've digressed already. We've only just started. Some areas have got loads of libraries. Like Warrington has got about a dozen libraries. Bury has got about three.
Right.
So it depends where you go. Some places have got tons of libraries. Some places haven't got tons of libraries. The problem is it's very bad PR to close libraries.
Yeah, of course.
So they tend not to close them. They tend to keep them open, even if no bugger goes in there. So, luckily for me, there's still plenty of libraries, and I will not rest until I've been to every one of them.
So, right. Okay. I mean, they'll be busier this winter, won't they? People will be going in there to keep warm, I think. There'll be a lot of people in libraries.
Yeah, well, that's the other funny thing about libraries is that actually for a lot of libraries, books is actually a minor part of what they do, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a citizens' advice bureau. It's a help centre. You can pay your bills, all this kind of thing. I mean, yeah. I sound like I'm a PR guy for libraries, but
no.
You know, if you're like me and you grew up in a house that didn't have books in it, then libraries are the greatest buildings in the world, you know?
Mm. Of course, yeah. I mean, I've always banging on about that, you know, that kind of third space where you know, somewhere, because people didn't have books, did they? I mean, no, I don't want to be like four Yorkshiremen, but they were expensive things, books, and libraries were an amazing part of my youth, or our youth.
We used to spend a lot of time, didn't we, in that one?
Yeah. And imagine being a card, being given a little piece of cardboard and, you know, with some writing on in biro and being told as a sort of curious kid, if you'll forgive the expression, if you take this bit of cardboard, you can look at any book that you want to.
Yeah.
Really? Honest? You know, amazing.
It's an amazing thing. Let's hope it has a bit of a resurgence. So the reason we've asked you on, before we leave the thing about the library tour, I went to see you at Altrincham Library a couple of weeks ago, and I've been to a few book events. I mean, I've done a few. I've been to too many at Steve's, I know that, but it was really, really an excellent book event. It was completely different from any other book event I've been to. You didn't read out of the book, for instance, did you?
No, why should, there's no point in, you know, having a dog and barking yourself, is there? You know, that's your job, to read the book, not my flipping job. And also, I don't like doing it because it's not designed to be read out. It's designed to be read inside your head.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit pointless anyway. And also, every time I do it, I go, oh, do you know what? I could have just switched that sentence around there and it would have been just that little bit better.
Yeah.
And it drives me mad. So I don't do it. And I do bill it as a kind of like, well, if you've been to a book do before, you haven't been to one like this. Yeah. And he's not a bloke just reading stuff out. It's like part therapy, part stand-up, part story, part, you know, there's some laughs in it, but there's some not laughs in it as well.
There's a couple of dark points there when I was there.
I wish I'd gone to Edgeley Library last week now.
Well, maybe if you had a time machine, you could do, even though this is going out live now.
Yeah. Yeah. I had COVID, that was my excuse.
Yeah, well, we know you'd COVID, yeah. We had to cancel the podcast.
Edgeley's this week, you're perfectly able to go to Edgeley.
Oh, is it?
I thought you were being clever.
I was getting a bit meta there. So you were pretending.
Yes.
Got you.
Yes. No.
I'm in
Highton and Edgeley and Bolton and Ramsbottom and Salford to Swinton. You name it. If it's a library.
Is it Friday?
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Well, I've got a double booking because Tom Ingley from the Inspirals is playing my local.
Well, sack him off then. There you go. You're done.
You've seen Tom, haven't you? Let's face it.
Yeah. I'll be done by half seven anyway, so you could do both.
I could probably do both, yeah. There's a night.
Right. You can listen to someone going on about themselves and the past, and then you can go and see David. So, moving on. So, I want to get to talking about those Sex Pistols gigs and who from the Fall was or wasn't there. But just by way of a bit of background, you started with at Granada, didn't you, doing the documentary first before you wrote the book about it?
I mean, I've been a journalist for a very long time.
Yeah.
And I've done it, you know, I've been a journalist since like 1981. So, I'd worked at newspapers and magazines. I worked at Piccadilly Radio for quite a long time.
261?
261, that's a sticker. And that's a really big thing. I tell people, you know, all the illustrious things I've done. And a lot of people of a certain generation will go, "You worked at Piccadilly? Bloody hell," you know. Because it was a massive, massive, massive deal to work at Piccadilly.
It was.
Massive.
Not as massive as me as Granada, because I mean, I think you picked up on this when you were talking. Granada, quite possibly, certainly if for music, is probably the greatest TV station ever, isn't it, in terms of
it was.
Music? You know, it was.
It absolutely, yeah, it is. And then I went to Granada as a reporter and I kind of worked my way up until I was making documentaries and stuff like that. And I was talking about this with one of my kids the other day, and he said to me kind of like, you know, before the internet and stuff like that, where did you get kind of information about bands and what was going on and what was worth checking out and what wasn't worth checking out. And bizarrely, the answer to that was, I watch my local news programme.
Yeah. I don't think there's a lot of people can say that. I don't think, you know, people in the South, there's a lot of, was the same, I don't think.
Yeah, you can't go to, nobody who grew up in Southampton could go like, yeah, I remember seeing that great Southampton band. Okay, well, there aren't any. and I saw them for the first time on TV Southwest.
Yeah.
At the end of the news. Of course not. But we're the blessed ones because, you know, we saw Joy Division at the end of Granada Reports.
Yeah.
First time. We saw Echo and the Bunnymen.
Yeah.
Doing, you know, pictures on a wall, you know, after they only formed a couple of weeks earlier.
Yeah.
You know, and then you've got all the treasure trove of the whole Granada archive, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say, because
you've got 30 seconds of the ball.
That's Granada. You know, the big documentary about the Doors.
Yeah. The Doors one, Stones in Hyde Park.
Stones in the Park, yeah. I'll tell you what else was. Johnny Cash live at San Quentin, that was Granada. Yeah,
so let's, I mean, what have you got? You got Jerry Lee Lewis in Studio 2. You got Sister Rosetta at Chorlton
Train Station, yeah.
You've got Mark Bolan. You've got all the kind of the pop stuff, you know, the Rollers and all of that. You've got So It Goes.
Mark Riley always reckons, you know, the big thing that everyone always goes about, Starman on Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
He saw him do it 2 weeks before on Lift Off with Aisha, which was a Granada programme.
So, yeah. So you've got all that. And then you've got, you So It Goes and your Other Side of Midnight. You've got, you know, it is this incredible. Imagine trying to make a TV documentary now if that Granada archive didn't exist.
Yeah.
You'd be knackered.
Definitely.
So I was part of that. And then I was just, you know, for a music kid like me to be then in basically given the keys to the kingdom. And that's what Granada was like. It was like, what do you want to make? Mm-hmm. Can you imagine? What do you want to make? You know, the first thing.
Why was it that free then?
It was because it was written into their constitution.
Right.
The Bernsteins wrote it into their kind of manifesto, if you like, that the main reason that Granada was there was to enrich the cultural lives of the people of the northwest of England. Okay. So it was written into the kind of like Blackpool through a stick of rock that anything creative was Granada's bag. And like the first, it sounds so weird saying it out loud, but the first series I ever made was called Wall of Fame. And we built a giant mural in Castlefield with famous creative Northwest people's faces on it. And as the artist painted it and drew it, we did these like little mini documentaries about Ian Curtis, Ellis Lowry, Gracie Fields, the Gallaghers, McCartney, Lennon, all of this. As the artist was painting them, it was the biggest piece of public art that had been made in Manchester for 30 odd years. Wow. And we just did it because we felt like it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Has it changed now, though?
Yeah, it's a news operation that they lost that when, you know, the analog switch over happened and all that remit that basically you had to make these kind of programs for the Northwest, mm-hmm. for Granada land, that disappeared. So the programs disappeared with it. So they'll never come back. You'll never have the like of that again.
Well, I mean, that's true about, there's no music programs on TV, is there at all?
Because music programs are an absolute pain in the ass to do. They're very expensive, and not many people watch them.
Right.
So, which is bad, bad for business.
Yeah, yeah. Basically. Of course.
And a program like I Swear I Was There, which is, you know, that I made, you know, that was my pet project that I wanted to make. That's basically why I joined Granada and fought my way up the ranks so that I could make I Swear I Was There. And there's no way that you could make that program now because it'd just be too expensive.
Right. Because, I mean, you got everybody, didn't you, really, for that? You know.
Yeah, absolutely, we got everybody. And also, the great thing about Granada, a bit like the kind of Piccadilly effect, really, which was you would ring someone up and say, will you do this? And they'd go, I'll give you an example. One of the loveliest people I've ever met, Jordan, who sadly died recently. Absolute queen of a woman. Absolute queen of a woman. And we rang her up and said, right, we're doing this program about, you know, who was at the Leicester Free Trade Hall in 1976 seeing the Sex Pistols and all that. Would you take part? And she said, no, you know, I mean, it's all in the past now. I don't really like talking about it. I'm very busy with, you know, my veterinary work and things like that. And who's it for again? I said, oh, it's for Granada. When do you want me?
Wow. When she was at our last gig in London, wasn't she, Paul?
She was.
What an absolute princess. And that was what it was like. People loved Granada.
Yeah.
And they loved the idea of it and the notion of it. And very rarely would anyone say no to us. People would say, who's it for? It's for Granada. When do you want me?
Well, that documentary has got one of my favourite interviews ever, which is Mike Rossi and Wayne Barrett. It's the, what a double act they were. Fantastic. Yeah.
Sadly, no more. A double act. They're not dead. They're just not double act.
No.
But yeah, that was one of these ones where I was doing this. And that's really where the kind of the book came into its own, which was the nature of television is that you throw away 98% of what you've got.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, this is cracking stuff, these lads. You know, there's a bit where he says, because Mike Rossi speaks with an American accent now.
Yeah.
and inevitably the subject of Withenshaw comes up. And Mike Rossi goes, hey, can I just say, hi to all the guys in Withenshaw. Okay. We'll be doing okay, guys. And I'm like, okay. So self-awareness has gone out the window.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
And there's just tons of it. And that's why, you know, the book came into its own is that I had all this other material that I couldn't use, this other 98% of whatever it was. And all this interplay between Barrett and Rossi and, you know, all loads of the fun stuff that, you know, Mark Smith said and that I couldn't really use. Yeah. And also just a little bit of, but you know the background and a bit of the extra explanation and stuff. So I was literally called into an office and said, you know, that program that you're making about Sex Pistols. Do you think you could write a book about it? And I was like, yeah, okay. And I did. In 90 seconds, I had like a book deal later. And again, that's so Granada that you would be called into an office, said, right, do you think you can do a book to go with this program? Yeah, right, okay, then piss off and write it.
thus the careers are made. There you go.
Yeah, it is
quite a sliding doors moment, wasn't it?
Totally. Yeah, and it's and it never. You know, when you see all these books and things and documentaries and what have you about Factory Records and Tony and things like that, and about all this, you know, all the crazy way that Factory Records was run, it's not crazy to me at all. It's the Granada model.
Yeah,
it's totally the Granada model, which is like. Have you got a good idea? Yeah, right. Well, we'll piss off and do it.
Yeah, but the thing with Factory, a lot of the time, have you got a bad idea? We'll go away and do it as well. There was a bit of that, wasn't there?
Yeah, but if we had a laugh doing it, then it was worthwhile.
Yeah, okay. So was Marky Smith at the first gig?
Here's the thing, right? Okay, so... Because when you asked me to do this, it all kind of comes flooding back now.
Yeah.
It's weird because I can't remember my kids' birthdays, but I can remember everything about I swear I was there. And we booked Mark in, and Mark came to Granada to do the interview. And and he was absolutely. I'm sorry. This is going to disappoint any of your many millions of listeners here, lads. Yeah. But he was absolutely nice as pie.
We're getting that. The more people we speak to, his interactions with with people he wasn't having an ongoing relationship.
I hate it when people say that. He was always nice to me.
it seems to be a trend, though, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And he wasn't just nice to me because I was the producer, and people are nearly always nice to the producer. Yeah. But he was nice to everybody else, which is very, very telling. So nice as pie. A polite choir boy, polite, and couldn't be more helpful. But when we were chatting beforehand, I said to, you know, so he said to me, like, you know, right. So what's all this about then? It's about Sex Pistols and Bless the Free Ted on that. So there you go. There's my Mark impression.
That's not bad,
you should do like a league. Get everybody to do it and then see who comes out top.
Henry Rollins is top of the charts at the moment.
About his superior Mark impression. So, what's that about, like, Sex Pistols and Free Ted on that? And I said, yeah, it is. Oh, said, all right, so like Buzzcocks and Slaughter the Dogs and all that. And I was like, oh, right, so you were at the second gig, right, okay. And and then we just did the interview, and then when I did the book, I think I maybe conveniently forgot that little exchange because it wasn't recorded. It was just right. Between me and him. And then I thought, and everything he said was all about the second gig and the, you know, the fighting and all this kind of stuff. But I think I kind of, maybe I did it on purpose, maybe I didn't, but I kind of forgot about that. And I put him in the first gig pile.
Right, okay.
Probably because it suited my purposes to do so. Because it's a better story, isn't it? And then when I went,
loads of riffraff at the second gig.
Anyone heard it? Yeah, very very poor door policy, in my opinion.
and out again.
But that's the nature of the story with the Free Trade Hall, is that it's a myth inside a myth, inside a conundrum, inside a lie, inside a myth.
I'll tell you what, this might be quite a trivial thing, but I was listening to an interview with you on Glossop Record Club. And right. it said the Lesser Free Trade Hall was above the Free Trade Hall.
Was it not?
Was it not below it?
No.
That's one of his most vivid memories, going up the stairs to that game.
That's sure it's underneath. No.
Well, that's the kind of, you know, revenge of memory. If you could see me now, I was asking you before if this was in vision. I'm wearing a Doll by Doll t-shirt. Blimey. And Revenge of Memory is a Doll by Doll reference, one of my favourite bands. And it's amazing how people will swear blind. We did a thing for Radio 2 a couple of years ago with Peter Hook. And Peter Hook swore blind that he remembers falling down the stairs to the Lesser Free Trade Hall. And we're all like, what are you talking about? It was upstairs. But he was literally willing to, you know, swear. He was willing to bet his house.
He didn't trip over you, Steve, did he? Because you were going down as well, didn't he?
So, but there you go. That's the beautiful thing about the story, is that it's this clash of knowledge and memory and all the rest of it. You know, I think the majority of people aren't liars. The majority of people who say, oh, I was at the gig, genuinely thought that they were. Mm-hmm. And it's only when you kind of, you know, you really, really, because bear in mind, this was 2000, 2001 that we did this first time round. We couldn't just type it onto the internet. We had to find it out, old school style. Yeah. And we formulated a questionnaire and all this kind of stuff. We had to do it old school style. And I don't think very few people are actual out and out liars. They're just, it's the revenge of memory. So, and that's what makes it fascinating. And in fact, I don't think I've ever told anybody this before, but I think enough time has passed now. When we first did, I swear I was there, I only had about 9 weeks to write it, which is pretty heavy when you're working on a program all day. And I managed to deliver it. And the publishers said, oh, it's not long enough. So Swan said, well, nobody told me how long it was supposed to be. And the publisher said, yeah, we did. It's in the contract. I'd never seen a contract. That's a very Granada thing. Very Granada move that was. So I had no idea. So they said, right, well, we can't publish this, so it's all off.
Oh, cool.
And I was like, well, I've just worked my guts out for this. I said, right, well, if you can add like 25,000 words to it by tomorrow.
What?
We'll publish it. So I went home in bits. I was distraught. I went home in bits. And what I did was all the stuff that was contradicted each other, where people contradicted another person, that kind of like journalistically was like, well, you know, well, we can't use that because it just contradicts something else. I put it all back in.
Right.
I literally scooped it all up, all the stuff where people contradicted each other, and I plonked it back in. And if I hadn't have done that, you and I, us three would not be having this conversation now.
Yeah.
And nobody would have, because it's the contradictions and the he said this and they said that and he was never there and all that kind of funny stuff.
Yeah.
That absolutely makes the book.
Made it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's a big argument about whose idea it was to get Slaughter and the Dogs on, isn't there? There was because if you ask Wayne Barrett, and they say that the Sex Pistols contacted them directly, and then Pete Shelley says I contacted him. I don't think Buzzcocks were massively pleased that they were on, were they?
No,
it wasn't. I think the hatred there, you know, survives to this day.
I know. I can't believe that. What? Why? Why didn't they like each other? Them two bands.
Because the Buzzcocks lads, particularly Devoto, fancied himself as the intellectual.
Mm.
And fancied himself as the artist, and you know, he literally says in the book that he didn't really, as he puts it, care for the whole aesthetic of punk.
Yeah,
and you imagine the lads from Withenshaw having to swallow that. You know, it's you know, the chalkiest and the cheesiest of mixes.
Yes, of course.
So it's not surprising in the slightest, is it? In a way.
I know, but you would think.
Well, they're not, in terms of bands, they're not that far apart, are they, really?
Not at all, no. I mean, you would think the intervening, whatever, 40 odd years, they would manage to gain some kind of perspective on it.
Well, lads, I don't need to be here explaining to you that there's no beef like old Manchester punk beef, is there?
No, indeed, yeah.
I shouldn't be explaining this to you, lads, should I?
So, What that interaction with Mark, so you interviewed him for that. So we're pretty sure he was at the second one now, aren't we? I think.
Yeah. But and when I did another editions, there's been quite a few editions of I Swear I Was There over the years. There's even an Italian edition, which I think I'm the only person who's got a copy of. So it's had a variety of editions, and I've added things over the years. And I've added, like, for example, after the first edition, somebody like left some photographs on the reception at Granada for me, and like, oh, I took some photographs at the first gig. I don't suppose you're interested. Yes, I am interested. This was before people saw the worst of things like this, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so we cut them into the second broadcast of the program, and then I included him in the next edition of the show. And that was Paul Welsh's pictures, which are actually on display at Manchester Central Library as we speak.
Yes.
So if you want to go along and have a look at Paul's pictures. So I was able to incorporate that, and then I found other people. I'm still doing it now. Even 20 years later, I'm still getting people coming up to me and saying, oh, I was at the gig and this, that, and the other. And in fact, if there's another edition of the book, I've got the scoop of all scoops that I'm sitting on and holding tight.
All right, okay. When we pretend to stop recording, you can tell us that.
Will I buggery? but
What can you say about it that's not already been said?
Well, that's the scoop, you see. That is the scoop right there.
It never happened.
it was all a dream, like Dallas. Well, yeah, Mark was great, and he, pretty much at the second gig, and it's his interview. People still remember it. Now, a mate of mine called Richard Makinson was the assistant producer on the programme, and he's now, you know, making amazing programmes of his own, and he's just done a great documentary on Britbox about British music. And as part of this, he had to interview Johnny Marr.
Yeah.
And he's having a chat with Johnny as the cameras are setting up, and Johnny says to him, oh, what other programs have you made? So he says, well, I've made this, I've made that. And I used to work at Granada and made quite a few music programs then. And Johnny says, oh, what like? He says, well, it was the assistant producer on I Swear I Was There. And Johnny's like, I love that program. Oh, God, I love it. I was watching it the other night. And do you remember my favorite bit? Johnny says, my favorite bit is where you ask Mark E. Swift a question and he drinks an entire bottle of beer while he's thinking about it and then answers the question.
It's a skill, that's, you know.
Yeah.
And he doesn't drop a beat either when he does it. No. And it's a really good answer he gives as well. We had a good, you know, we had a couple of beats. It was, I'm going to say, we did the interview. It wasn't quite lunchtime when we did the interview, but we had a few beers and we had a good time and all the rest of it. And it was just really, really good. And just cracking stories, like, you know, Mark saying that they were in Cox's bar. which is round, which was round the back of the free trade hall, and he's in Cox's bar, and he says, and this bloke comes in with like ginger curly hair and winkle pickers and that. It's Martin McLaren, and Martin McLaren says to him, "Are you coming to the gig, lads?" And we said to him, "Oh, we're just weighing it up, Malcolm." You know, so just great stuff. You know, just funny, and that's I think I swear I was there. I've got a funny little place in kind of music documentaries and in books is that it is actually, it's really funny.
Yeah.
It's a funny program. You're
completely in that Sex Pistols film, the Steve Jones. Did you see that?
I did. I liked it, but there wasn't many laughs in it, was there?
It was a bit grim, but they completely avoided the whole Manchester thing, didn't they?
Maybe, you know, because Danny Ball's from up the road, isn't he? So, maybe he thought, well, you know, Nolan's got that pretty well covered. I don't want to be treading on his territory.
Well, of course, yeah.
but it has, you know, I mean, again, we're looking at it now in terms of now, but when we did it first time round, this was all new territory, this, that people, someone would take the time and trouble to go and track down Solstice, the support band. It's kind of like, it's actually like music books now, really, is that music books now tend to not be, oh, here's a book about, you know, the 1975 or something like that. Music books now tend to be more kind of conceptual, which, like, tracking down, like, there's a lad who's just done one where he's tracked down all the bands who were on the C86 cassette.
Yes. Oh, yes. That's right. I've seen that,
Yeah.
It's called, isn't it? Is it called Totally Wired? That's a different book talking
about. No, so they tend to be kind of like ideas books.
Yes.
Like about, you know, like the, Ted Kessler's just done one about the last days of Q magazine. Mm-hmm. And so it's about a kind of an idea or a concept rather than a specific band or even a specific genre. And I'd like to think that a lot of those kind of things have you know, come from I Swear I Was There, which was like one of the first kind of conceptual books. It's not about the Sex Pistols. It's about this idea and this notion of the free trade hall, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that, you know, any other recent books maybe written by a Hanley might have drawn inspiration from this. I'm not saying that.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
That's a yes then.
I told you that at the time on Twitter. I told you that today. I was really inspired by that book to sort of look at the bigger kind of, rather than just being, this is what happened. Because I don't think, you don't really need to look for facts anymore, do you, in books? I don't, you know, you need them, but there has to be more to it than that, I think, doesn't there?
It has to be something more than I could look up on the internet.
Yes.
And that's always the thing that I've always aimed for with my, you know, and I've written lots of books about lots of different musical genres, but the thing I'm always after is the thing that you find out whereby someone has to go and change Wikipedia because of something that I found out. And it's, and I think this music's so fragmented now that this idea of, oh, a single band or a single movement, I mean, you don't really get movements anymore, do you? But that can unify everybody or unify a large number of people, that's gone.
Yeah.
So that's why you get less books that are specifically about bands and more books that are about, are like conceptual and are more about ideas and about record labels or with a concept or a conceit, you know.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Yeah. So there's the question for you. Was it that important then, that those two Sex Pistols gigs?
It does beg the question, would then people have formed bands anyway, really?
Yeah, I mean, there's two ways of looking at the whole free trade whole thing. One way of looking at it is it threw a match onto something that was already kind of soaked in petrol.
Okay. Right.
And would Peter Hook have gone to Mazel Radio and bought his bass for 30 quid the day after or not? Now, he says he wouldn't have done that, and I take his word for it.
Yeah.
It's this spark, and it's this idea, and it's concept, and it's this explosion which creates another series of explosions, which create another series of explosions. And it's like a game. And Paul Morley, says this in the book really articulately, which is like, it's like a game that you can play, which is like you can trace things back to the Lesser Free Trade Hall by saying to someone, right, who's your favourite band? Green Day. Okay. Green Day, Buzzcocks, Free Trade Hall. Okay. Mm-hmm. Who's your favorite band? Interpol. Okay. Interpol, Joy Division, Free Trade Hall.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's like a parlor game that you can play.
It's like 6 degrees of separation.
Yeah, it is. The other way of looking at it is that it is a conceit and a nonsense largely invented by Tony Wilson because it suited his narrative.
Yeah.
And which got some interesting results. Am I allowed to swear on this?
Yeah, you can tell me that.
Yeah, right, okay. So Tony Wilson was very, very protective of this. And as you may know, I wrote a book about Tony as well after he died.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Tony was very supportive of I Swear I Was There. And in fact, he came into a meeting once, and it was his idea to include the first TV performance and this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
That was Tony's idea. And it was a really good idea to have like the three events during the summer of 76 in Manchester. Brilliant idea. That was Tony's idea. So when the book was re-released, Tony at the time wasn't quite on his uppers, but he wasn't far off. And he was doing a program on a Saturday morning for BBC Radio Manchester. And he would have like people on and interesting people on and this, that, and the other. And he had me on to talk about the new edition of I Swear I Was There. Yeah. And he was great and super supportive and this, that, and the other. And we had to go to the traffic and travel, and which means that the mics go off. So we went to the traffic and travel, and Tony gets up, and he's a big guy. He was a big guy, Tony Wilson. You know, for me, I'm reasonably petite, and he was, you know, so he was a big bloke. And he stood up and he loomed over me and he said to me, "You saying in the book was that I wasn't at that gig was fucking snide." And then he goes, "Ah, thanks for the traffic and travel there." And back with me now is David Nolan, author of I Swear I Was There. And let's talk more about the Sex Pistols at the Free Trade Hall. Like nothing had happened. he was not happy about it at all. But
he was at the second one, wasn't he?
Well, he swore blind that he was at the first one because that suited his narrative.
Ah, right, okay.
That suited his narrative. But even though I'd managed to line up a dozen people who said that he wasn't there, he still wouldn't have it. And he would not have it at all. But because that was Tony's kind of conceit, was that all the clever creative people in Manchester were at the first gig. And that's where the explosion was. And the second one was all full of, no offence, oiks.
Right, okay.
So that was Tony's narrative.
Not taken, eh, Steve?
No, no, absolutely.
Right,
what so... Said, it's got to be said, though, Tony, you know, if it wasn't for Tony, then you have to bear in mind, you know, going back to that Granada Land thing, you know, the first time, we should really talk about the Four, should we, at some stage?
At some point, yeah. That was my
first exposure to the Four, was on Granada doing his Industrial Estate.
Yes.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So that was my first exposure to the Fall. And, you know, whatever, you can say a lot of things about the Call, but my God, that's a catchy song.
It is, yeah.
My God, even my kids now, when they see a sign, when we're driving through Bredbury or something like that, and we see a sign that says industrial estate, my kids will start going, yeah, yeah, you know, in the back of the car, because it's the catchiest song, you know, ever written. It's brilliant. And so that was my first exposure to the Four. Again, it's that Granada Land effect.
It is, yeah. Well, had you hooked up with them by then, Steve, when they were all, I think you might have, yeah. No,
not when they filmed it. I'd met them somewhere in between them filming it and it coming out,
right?
And it being on. So I didn't know them when they filmed that.
Yeah, because that was actually. If you watch it, it's really well filmed.
Yeah.
It's on really good. It's really good quality. It's really well shot. And again, sorry to go on about it, but that's the Granada effect, is that you would work with camera operators and sound guys and editors and things like that who'd worked on. I can remember going to film like some news item, and the guy who like shot it had worked on blooming Jewel and the Crown or Rise and Revisited.
Yeah.
And I remember editing something with a guy once, and I said, oh, you know, what else have you done? And he said, oh, you know, I've done The Ups. I said, what do you mean? I said, I've done The Ups, you know, 7 Up, 14 Up, 21 Up.
Oh, right, okay.
The greatest documentary series ever made.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this guy who's editing my little piece of nonsense had worked on The Ups, you know, so that's what it was like. And that's another reason why I think a lot of the bands were really, really well served by Granada, because they had this amazing talent working on it and make it. You go on YouTube now and have a look at that.
Yeah.
It's Psycho Mafia as well, I think, as well.
It is, yeah. That Joy Division one in particular is really good, isn't it?
Totally. And they got that, you know, and they got that footage, which was World in Action footage of motorways.
Yes,
and things like that, and put it over the top of it and stuff. You're talking about people who were, and in many cases are, the best of the best.
Yeah.
The best of the best. And because Granada was a pool, sometimes the best of the best would be working on, you know, Cracker. With Robbie Coltrane or something like that. And then another day, they might be out filming with me and filming a band or something like that. Mm-hmm. Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Well, get that at TV Southwest in blooming Southampton.
No, you don't. We were on Granada Reports one time. I mean, I think they only ended up showing about 15
seconds of it, yeah.
But it was, it was Richard Madeley, wasn't it, introducing us, you know, at the end. And then now just to play us out, here's the Four doing Solicitor in studio.
Yeah.
I'd love to see a proper film of that, because there is only the film taped off the TV, I think.
That's what we used to call, what we used to refer to as under the outro.
Yeah.
Which was that you would have a certain amount of items and things, which was you would put them on the running order under the outro in case something went down or something went wrong.
Right. Okay.
And then you could drag them up. So it could be a brass band from Oswald Twistle. Or it could be, you know, the St. Winifred's Choir, or it could be Joy Division, or it could be The Four.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So depending on how short of time we were or how much the running order had changed, that depended on how much airtime you got. So sometimes you could get like 15 seconds, or fortunately, like for the case of Joy Division, we got basically the full Monty.
Yeah.
So it entirely depended on what chaos had happened during the program, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So when did you see the UCL4 live then? How early on were you involved in watching
the band? So I started going to gigs in the kind of very, very early 1979, I suppose.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because going into Manchester, I grew up in Altrincham, and so going into Manchester became my addiction.
Yeah, you know, me too.
I was addicted to going into Manchester, and I'm sure, like a lot of people, and I'm sure we've got a shared experience here. You're 14, and you're in Pips, and you're in the clubs, and you're in Stuffed Olives, and you're in, you know, you're in the Squat, and you're in here, there, and everywhere, and you're trying to blag your way into the university and stuff like that. When you're 14, I mean, I think about it now with my kids, you know, I'm thinking, oh God, you know, if my kids had done what I was doing when I was like 14, 15, you know, gonna have a heart attack.
Russell Club at 14. Yeah,
absolutely. Or the Osborne Club. Do you remember the Osborne Club?
The Osborne, yeah.
Yeah, that was, I remember seeing, you go there and you'd see like, you know, angelic upstarts or Cockney rejects and things like that. And they were like big fights with gigs occasionally breaking out.
Yeah,
you know?
That's right. They were pretty malevolent places, some of them gigs, weren't they?
You got off the bus there and you'd get off the bus and you'd run into the venue. and again, this is, I'm sure, you know, you lads can probably relate to this. You know, this is punk, 78. Yeah. You know, I started kind of dressing punky in sort of late 77. That kind of thing, 78. And bear in mind, dressing punky at that time was wearing straight leg jeans.
Yeah.
If you wore straight leg jeans, you'd get chased down the street.
Yeah. The whole thing about, you know, it came much later, I think, you know, when you see like they try and recreate gigs and they've all got bloody Mohicans and
nobody dressed like that, did they? Have you ever seen that? Have you ever seen that picture of the queue for the Electric Circus?
Yeah.
Everyone's got flares on.
Yeah, of course they have. Yeah, I mean, and you could get chased down the street for having slightly short hair.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of boldness of it. So then I would be seeing the fall at the university and at the Polytechnic and stuff like that. And I can remember particularly at the university really sticks it in my mind because Mark Smith was very, very cross about something on stage. I don't know if this is obviously a bit of a scoop for you here, lads. You know,
what do you mean?
Instead of his usual kind of target, his target was the sound man. And he was banging on about it. Sounds like a whirlpool up here. Sounds like a whirlpool. It's like a whirlpool up here. It's like a whirlpool going on and on and on. Yeah. About, is this a new song called Whirlpool? And I genuinely thought, this is like a new song called Whirlpool. And it wasn't. It was just him going on about the sound.
Yeah,
sounded like a whirlpool.
He did have a right go at sound people at times.
I think Stuart Lee mentioned this, you know, in one of your other programs, that there was always this feeling with the fall was like, should we go and see the fall on Saturday? He says, I'm going to go and see, I'm going to see the Skids at the Apollo. But it'd be all right because we'll go and see him again in another couple of weeks. Because say what you will about the fall, very hardworking lads.
Yeah.
Very professional.
Professional, hardworking, yeah. But that's the thing, you know, people who say, yeah, I worked with him briefly and I'll interact with him and he was really, really nice. None of them are sound men, are they?
No, all bass players. Yeah, but, you know, speak as you find, lads, speak as you find.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But that's we were talking to James Brown last week and he was saying he always made a point of being polite and to, you know, people who were working, like so a barmaid or, you know, a waiter or anybody who was, like you say, if there was on a program, someone, a runner or whoever.
Absolutely.
To be polite to those people.
That is the test of, you know, whether someone's a dick or not is they talk to, like in television, because there's a lot of dicks in television, trust me, is how people talk. How people talk.
I was going to say about the lyrics to Solicitor in Studio.
Young dicks make TV.
Absolutely. And you can tell. And bands have come into Granada giving it all that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, giving it all that and telling I remember, towards my end of my time there, a band coming in and a very, very well known band coming in. And literally the first thing they said to the runner was like, right, we want you to toddle off and get us some coke right now. That's your job. That's your only job. And like, you know,
go on.
Absolute Charlie's. And actually a band I happen to really like, but that you get people who are like that.
Yes.
Who are not nice. They tend to be nice to the producers and the directors and the cameramen, but they can be right nasty with the runners and this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, you know, Mark was really nice. And we actually had to get, it's all coming back to me now, lads. It's all coming back to me. We had these bottles of, I think, Budweiser or Beck's, something like that. But obviously, you're not allowed to show. It was Budweiser. You're not allowed to show like labels and things like that on telly. Yeah. So we had the girl who worked on the program, and she had a penknife, and she was underneath the table scraping the labels off these beer bottles so that Mark could drink them on camera.
Yeah, right, okay.
But the trouble is, he was drinking them quicker than she could scrape the labels off. So I still got this image of her underneath this kind of out of view going, trying to scrape these labels off. You know, happy days. Yes, but yeah, he nice as pie. And he, you know, and actually, most people are, you know, the divvies are, in my experience, you know, the minority, fortunately. Yeah. You know, and you know, it's that thing of, you know, meeting your heroes and stuff like that. And, you know, most of the heroes I've met have been brill.
Right. So the other thing I was going to ask about, well, we'll have to get onto your later writing career, because I was fascinated by that, the kind of switch between, without, I'm not trying to denigrate, but the kind of pop kind of books you were writing to the well, there's the pivotal moment in there. Well, probably not the place to go into what made you change into darker waters, shall we say.
You'll have to come and see me at Edgeley, lads.
You'll have to go and see me at Edgeley. I want to ask you about Manc Noir, the books that you've written, the three books. I'm halfway through. I'm taking Black Moss on my holiday tomorrow to finish it.
All right.
Which I'm really enjoying.
It's an ideal holiday read of murder and stuff.
Yeah. I asked you this question at the event about when you first started writing crime fiction. Did you know the rules of crime fiction? And your answer was very good. It was basically no, wasn't it?
Basically, yeah. And I didn't. The music books, and I've, you know, done all sorts of music books and stuff like that. And I was, you know, a professional music author, and publishers knew that they could ring me up and say, you know, can you do us an Ed Sheeran book, you know, sharpish? And they knew that I could do it and I'd do a good job and bang it out on time and we wouldn't get sued.
Yeah.
And in fact, my world record is, so I don't know why I'm laughing, it's not funny. I got rung up by publishers and said, right, we're thinking of doing a book about George Michael for the first anniversary of his death. I said, "All right, yeah, okay, I can see that working. It's gonna be lots of pictures, but we need the words to go with it. You know, about 20,000, something like that. Could you write it about George Michael?" I said, "Yeah, okay, yeah." And they said, "Right, thing is, we want it for Monday."
What?
And it was they rang me.
What day was it?
It was Monday afternoon. So they wanted it for the following Monday. And they said, "We know it's a tall order, but you know, if you make it, we'll give you a bonus." And right. I got my bonus.
Wow.
So as a good professional, sometimes I was writing books that I wanted to write, like the Tony Wilson book and 1975 and stuff like that. And sometimes you're writing books because, you know, you could do with a new bathroom.
Yeah.
And that's you know, that's, you know, very professional. And, I got involved in a sort of a case, you know, from, you know, a terrible sort of true life crime case. So I wrote a book about that because I had kind of inside knowledge of it. And then that kind of put it into perspective a bit, really. I wanted to write about things that I thought were important, like child protection, you know, online grooming, the rise of the far right. You know, I had Tommy Robinson standing as my MEP in Stockport. No likey. So things like that that were kind of making me angry, but I didn't have an outlet for it, obviously writing books about Ed Sheeran and stuff. So I channeled it into these kind of, you know, what we now call Manc Noir books, which I've done three, you know, Black Moss, Mermaid's Pool, and now the Ballad of Hanging Leaves.
Yeah.
And I'm able to channel in the things that I am angry about and kind of couch them, hide them under the guise of crime fiction. And actually, it's not really crime fiction. It's me banging on about things that I'm really angry about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's easier to tell the truth in fiction, isn't it, I think, in some ways, about some of these things. It's very difficult to get across the actual feelings that people have about some of these events if you just sort of tell them what really happened. You know, do you know what I mean? There's a thing with fiction where you can get to a greater truth, I think.
Yeah, in a funny way, you can say things in fiction that you can't say, that you would like to say.
Yeah.
But either because the lawyers won't have it, or this, that, and the other, you can't say in factual books. And I've, you know, found that out to, you know, to my cost. Literally, because
I mean, quite freeing then for you.
Yeah, you can be. Yeah, because I can remember, I wrote the first kind of, you know, non-music factual book I wrote about, which was about, it was involving the Catholic Church. And I can remember going to all these insurance companies, trying to get, see if I could get insurance against me being sued by the Catholic Church. And not a single place in the country would touch me. Not one. Wow. And that reminds you of, you know, the telling the truth can be a costly affair, but it's very hard to do that if it's if you say it's a work of fiction.
Yeah.
You can't sue me. It's a work of fiction. So it's amazing what you can get away with under the guise of a crime thriller. So yeah. I unapologetically, I write about heavy things, but in the guise of crime fiction, but also I like to think with a certain kind of, Manchester kind of humor to it as well. They're very sarcastic. People take the piss out of each other in the books. Yeah. And that's what it's like. You know, I was a crime reporter, and the darkest of humor is found between crime reporters and the police.
Yeah.
You know, just because it's the way you get through
it. Yeah.
I mean, without being a flippant tie back, but there's a lot of that in the story with Ian Curtis. There's they cope with that, don't they? The band cope with that with a lot of dark humor, I think.
It is. And, you know, this kind of like very kind of Manchester shrug of the shoulders of like, oh, you know, see you at rehearsal tomorrow then.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And it is a kind of a dark story. But, you know, I did a book about Bernard Sumner, and a lot of the stories there, particularly from Terry Mason, who was the guy who was there right from the start, Terry. And Terry's a good friend of mine now. And some of the stories, you know, they're just cracking stories, funny stories. And I think it's a bit of a shame when you see things like, you know, films like Control and stuff like that. You're like, you know, where were the laughs?
Yeah,
where was this notion of young lads just having a laugh and having a whale of a time and up to mischief? Where was that? You know, it makes me sad a little bit that it is people want things to be a certain way. They want The Fall to be a certain way. They want Marky Smith to be a certain way. They want the Joy Division to be a certain way. They want Tony Wilson to be, you know, people want it in a certain way. And when you actually present, you know, the reality, some people don't like it. It's if you've got a choice between, you know, the truth and the legend, print the legend.
The legend,
Well, no, fuck off. You know, how about this? Yeah. If the truth is good enough, it'll become a legend on its own.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. You don't have to polish it or embellish it or add any whistles and bells to it. If it's good enough, if the truth is good enough, it'll become a legend itself. Thank you very much. And I'm very much of that view, that tell people the truth and then, you know, if through that it becomes a legend, brilliant.
But, I mean, then you get back to the thing about the I swear I was there. There's more than one truth, though, isn't it?
Yeah, there is, and you lay them all out, and then the people argy-bargying with each other, you know, it always makes me smile. Ian Moss, who's in the book, who's a good pal of mine, and a great bloke.
Yes.
Absolute cracking bloke, Ian. You know,
you just got him up out of the audience.
you ask him, all right, was Mick Hucknall there? And Ian says, I didn't see no Charlie Drake lookalikes. You know, just great lines, you know, great one-liners, you know, that people come out with, and people who know they're being funny, and some people who don't realise that they're being funny. But, you know, as long as it's funny, you know.
Yeah, yeah. The bat's a bit rusty again, aren't
it? In a way, yeah. But again, it's, you know, there's nothing more, you know, I'm struggling to think of another book where it's a music book that is genuinely funny.
Yeah.
genuinely funny. And we've got
present company accepted, yeah. Obviously.
No, sorry. You must have misheard me there. I'm struggling to think of any books at all. No, you know what I mean? But music and humour don't sit very well together.
No.
And particularly Manchester music, because it's supposed to be this thing, isn't it?
Yes.
It's supposed to be, you know, on the bridge, in the snow, you know, Anton Corbin pictures and all that kind of
industrial.
Yeah, it's supposed to be that. But actually, it's funny. You know, you're talking about funny people who've done some funny things, and very often we'll say them in a funny way. Yeah. So that's great. You know,
that's one of the things you can say about Mark E. Smith. A lot of people miss the humour in what he was saying. People treat his lyrics with this kind of reverence, but there's a lot of humour in there that either people don't pick up on or don't want to pick up on, I think.
I think that's a very astute comment, actually, that people don't want to.
Yeah.
They'd rather have it, you know, like a bit like that mosquito in Jurassic Park, you know, set in the amber.
Yeah.
And it's preserved just like that.
Yes.
Just perfectly preserved. That's how they want it. And I'm not your man in that case. Because that's not what it's like. You know, that's not what, as you say, this idea of like, it's punk rock. Let's have loads of people jumping up and down in with Mohicans because it's the Sex Pistols. Well, people were still wearing flares until the early 80s around our way.
Nobody had the money to go out and get a new wardrobe just because it seems on your own, did they?
And that's another one. That's a cracking story. I think Pete Shelley tells this story, and I swear I was there about, and it's not the kind of thing you could use in the program, but you use it in the book, whereby talking about Howard Devoto going to a tailor's to have his trousers taken in. and the tailor is saying to him, look, once I do it, you know, I can't undo it. You've ruined a perfectly good pair of trousers here, Howard. You know, and all these people trying to talk him out of having his trousers taken in, which is great because you couldn't, you know, he had to really save up to buy a pair of like straight trousers from the back of Sounds, from those. Do you remember those adverts in the back of Sounds?
Yeah. T-shirts and all that. Yeah,
all of that. And I can remember buying a pair of PVCs. Again, this would have been about 79, I guess, 78 or something. And buying a pair of PVCs from those. And I wore them once and all of the plastic fell off them. But actually, they looked pretty cool because a few bits were still left. They looked quite funky, you know. And, you know, to buy the, you know, the gear and go to, do you remember Roxy in the underground market?
Yes, yes. I do.
Yes.
Yeah, to go there, which was, and Roxy was like, it was our version of Sex on the King's Road, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And to go there and buy a T-shirt or buy a jumper or something like that, you're talking about, you know, that's a lot of Saturday job money, that.
Oh, right, yeah.
And, yeah, so this notion of all the Sex Pistols were played, everybody's got a Mohican, is a nonsense.
Yes. Well, I think that was one of, certainly with the Fall, the Never, Martin Mark, you know, you had a thing where, you know, you put on a smart shirt, or, you know, there's no way he was ever going to be, Sid Snot or anything like that. There was that kind of working class. You want to look smart, don't you, when you go out, I think.
Well, it seemed to me, looking at it and watching, you know, watching you on stage and watching the Four, like on Granada and things like that, that to me seemed punky to be wearing not even, you know, straight, like parallel jeans.
Parallels. Yeah,
to wear parallels was punky because you could get beaten up by, you know, by the Perry Boys or whatever. You could get beaten up for wearing those, or you could get beaten up for wearing, a Harrington jacket.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
stakes were pretty low.
Yeah, but so this notion of, and then the weird thing was, you know, then literally, you know, like 18 months later, you'd be on the bus going, you know, on the 261 bus to Pips, you know, and wearing makeup and all the rest of it. And then, bloody hell, I tell you what, you took your life in your hands.
You know, I was that soldier.
It makes us sound like we spent our whole lives getting beaten up.
Well,
probably not too far from the truth, though.
Running away.
Effort in not getting beaten up, I think. Yeah. You always had one eye on your shoulder, didn't you? Yeah.
Yeah, running away, yeah, but largely, yeah. But it was to get onto a bus and go into town dressed not in the norm. Yeah. Was quite, you know, particularly for a young, you know, I was, you know, 14, 15, you know, in the late 70s. That was quite I look back and thinking, that was quite a ballsy thing to do that.
Yeah. Actually, yeah.
Kids today.
They don't know them all, do they? Well, I think we've reached the end of our hour, David. That was absolutely fantastic.
Fascinating. Did we talk about the fall in the end?
Touched on it.
Loads of people talk about the fall.
Yeah. They do, don't they? But not many people talk about getting beaten up on the 261 bus for wearing makeup.
All night bus.
All night, crash it. Right, well, it just remains to thank you for coming along. Yes. That was really, really good. Thank you. If you can get to that library thing, Steve, or anybody listening, if you can get along to see David speaking, you really should do it, because it's a fascinating story from start to finish. There's a bit in the middle that we didn't touch on that it's definitely worth hearing. It's not exactly light entertainment, but
yeah, no, I always say to the library folks, you know what I'm going to do for you tonight? I'm going to do you the best author talk you've ever had. That is what I literally say to him beforehand, and then afterwards they come to me and say, do you know what, David, that probably was. Because it does take people by surprise. But yeah, loads of all sorts of ones coming up at the library. You know, if you give us a follow, I'm on at Nolan Writer on Twitter. I'm always banging the new dates out. I'm going into January now, so next year. So you know, if you've got a town and it's got more than three books on a shelf, I classify that as a library, and I would come and talk at it.
Fantastic. Right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Easy,
have a good day. Thanks a lot. That's
great.
Thanks for joining us for episode 2 of series 3 of Old Brother. The next episode will be released in 2 weeks. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Old Brother Show, where you'll find links to our Spotify playlist, or why not subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher or RSS, so you'll be all set for the next episode. You can give us a rating on iTunes, subscribe on YouTube, or just tell your friends if you fancy it too. For further reading, David's brilliant Manc Noir books are published by Fahrenheit Press. Our books about the fall, The Big Midweek and Our Bleeding Guests, are available from Root Publishers and all good bookstores. Hope to speak to you all again soon, and remember, if you're driving, check your car. Ta-da!